Attention, attention. You are listening to a pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. Curious Realm is busy traveling the vast void of time and space to find the best paradigm-changing content the universe has to offer. Enjoy the following transmission, and remember, stay curious. Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
And welcome to this episode of The Curious Realm. We are very pleased to be here live with the amazing Dr. John Hall. It has been quite a while since you've been on the show, my friend. The audience has been asking about you. The community has been asking about you. How have things been going for you?
Well, been a little on the down low, Chris.
Yeah.
You know some of the story. And I did want to kind of take this opportunity with Chris to just kind of... in the TI community. Several of my TI friends have been very supportive of some things I've been going through lately. Mm. But for those of you that don't know, yes, I'm going through a divorce. Found out that my wife was cheating on me not long before our daughter turned a year old in March. And wound up going through a divorce and a custody battle. Yeah. So that's been occupying a lot of my time, and have had to kind of limit my footprint since lawyers are involved on both sides.
Yeah. Well, because you, especially being involved in the TI community like you are, everything else, tend to have a pretty public face with that, as opposed to a lot of people who don't necessarily go out and share a lot of articles and get out and, you're pretty vocal about your involvement in the TI community.
And
your crusade against.
And I didn't shut down my personal Facebook page.
Yeah.
And I do appreciate some of my TI friends that have reached out, figured out from some of my posts that, you know, there was some life trauma. Yeah. Going on, and Chris and I were talking before we went on camera. In addition, while all of that was going on, just so people do know in the community, I can't talk a lot about it, but there is a big case going on involving targeting against the Navy that I'm an expert witness in. I do have a gag order on me specifically, given to me directly by the judge.
Yeah.
So I can't talk much about it, but it is a big case. So trying to prepare all my documents for divorce and for custody, prepare all my documents for this case against the Navy, which has already started. And then on top of that, had two near misses with death in the last 6 months. I was telling Chris, I'm a beekeeper. A lot of people may know that or may not. I do post occasionally about my bees, but I've been stung a million times and never had a problem with bee stings. Until one Saturday evening in May, was my one-year-old daughter got stung in the side of the throat and went into anaphylactic shock and came to with paramedics in my bathroom doing chest compressions on me and starting IVs, rushed me to the hospital, and obviously survived. And then about 6 weeks ago, had complications after a screening colonoscopy, because I'd been putting off having a screening colonoscopy for years, till finally a friend of mine convinced me, that's a gastroenterologist, to just come in, I'll do you on a Saturday, we'll be in and out. Complications are rare. Nicked an artery in my colon, and I almost bled to death on a Monday morning, wound up in the hospital, getting a second colonoscopy and getting the bleeder sealed up and getting blood and being revived that time too. So there's been a lot of personal issues, but I am still in the fight, even though I haven't been quite as public, just because of so much going on. So,
well, and before we get into our question of targeting technologies, the dangers that abound with this. Recently, I had the opportunity to go to the International Association for Near-Death Studies conference. Did you have any experiences while you were in the midriff, so to speak, Dr. Hall?
I would like to tell you that I did, but honestly, in my last memory, I was looking in the mirror thinking, oh my God, you look pretty horrible. And I had 911 on the phone.
Yeah.
Because I knew I was having visual changes. My blood pressure was dropping. I was home alone with a one-year-old. So I told them, the door's open. Don't kick in the door. I'm probably going to be on the ground when you get here. I think I dropped at about 5 till 6, and they were there right at 6, I think, because I know it was 6:07 when I came to, getting chest compressions and getting two large IVs put in each arm. My last memory was just seeing myself in the mirror. My face was swollen. I was all hived up. My eyes were bloodshot. I was beet red.
Yeah.
I'd like to tell you some really interesting story.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's interesting because one of the things that we have talked about regularly on this show, especially when it comes to paranormal, near death, things like that. What about those who are other than with their experience? You know, because every time, frequently, whenever I spent like a minute dead while they were trying to revive me. Many people do have a story, but there's a lot of people that don't. Yeah. And a lot of people don't realize that. And it's okay if you come back and you didn't like visit another place, you don't have like a new life mission. You didn't have like an angel guy taking you.
And I've had the same question. I've had patients that have died on the table that I revived and asked. As a matter of fact, I've got a very good friend of mine that's a chiropractor that had spinal surgery. Straight up died on the table. I mean, he was, you know, I wasn't his anesthesiologist, but the anesthesiologist that he had, I knew, and they spent, you know, probably 7 or 8 minutes trying to get him back. And I asked him the same thing. I said, well, you know, did you see anything, any of the lights or anything? He's like, no. You know, he didn't see anything either. And I said, well, you know what? Make some shit up. I mean, it's...
Yeah, that's...
you know, make it interesting, you know?
Yeah.
But I mean, I would... That there was. But my last memory was just thinking, you're going down. And sure enough, I mean, that's exactly what happened. But thank God I had 911 on the phone because when I initially called them, told them, look, I'm a beekeeper. She goes, well, do you have epi there? And I said, well, no, I'm a beekeeper. I get stung all the time. I've never had a reaction.
Yeah.
So I wasn't known bee allergic, venom allergic.
Yeah.
Now I am now. I went and got tested and I certainly have, Hymenoptera. Systemic allergies.
So. Not a lot of people realize, actually, that whenever you dial 911, you immediately become a transponder.
Yeah.
Like, they are tracking your location and everything for, like, the next 3 hours.
Well, luckily, when I had them on the phone, I was already having visual changes.
Yeah.
I told them, this is my address, my door's open. I probably won't be conscious when you get here because I was stumbling through the house looking. You know, like I said, when I came to, I was what the chest compressions are what brought me back to consciousness. And I could hear my daughter screaming in the bedroom when a deputy sheriff leaned over and I said, my daughter's crying. And like, she's all right. She's in her crib. And there was probably two deputy sheriffs in there, probably 3 or 4 paramedics getting ready to load me up. And thank God I left the front door unlocked so I didn't have to replace a door.
Yeah.
You know, because when I knew I was going down, that was my big fear. And I'm like, oh, I've got this big mesquite door. They're going to kick off the hinges and that's going to be $1 or something to repair. But got me to the ER and the same thing when I was bleeding out Monday morning, I got to the hospital, luckily, before I passed out and had bled down from a normal hemoglobin and hematocrit down to a 6 hemoglobin. And they had to do another colonoscopy and find the blood. So there's been a lot going on in my life.
It's no bit.
Kevin, but I did make it to that hearing for the Navy.
Yeah, yeah. And we were in touch the day that you were doing that. It was interesting to hear your response to it. Things like that. Like you said, you were under active gag order. I don't know any more gory details than you're able to tell on the show tonight, just for those of you who know.
Well, and I wouldn't violate that gag order because I would be disservicing the TI that actually.
Yeah, the victim that you're actively trying to representation. And let's start getting into that topic real quick, because not a lot of people are, some people, even right now, there's a good, probably I'd say 60% of the American public that is not fully aware of the phenomena of Havana syndrome and the fact that we had, it's named after the ambassadors that were targeted in Havana, Cuba first, but there were ambassadors and possible family members in China, and there were ambassadors targeted in D.C. And it wasn't until D.C. the hearings started happening, that a full-on investigation started happening, and that they coined the term immaculate concussion for this soft tissue brain damage that's suffered by obviously a high-order technology that's not an off-the-shelf. Like, I have a parabolic speaker. Tell the person across the street on their porch to turn their music down, and if they step off the porch, they won't hear it. You can buy that technology on eBay and build a kit.
Audio spotlight.
Yeah, yeah. But this is something totally different, where literally their brain has been vibrated to a point that there is irreparable soft tissue damage.
And they're having all the same symptoms. I talked to some of those victims, and they had gag orders on them.
Absolutely.
Most of them. Especially the Canadian victims, they are filing suit against the Canadian government. And it will be a matter of time till the victims here file suit against our government.
Yeah.
Because our government is not completely taking them seriously either. Yes, there's been investigations, but those investigations have kind of been led down the psychological or psychiatric issues. Because remember, they were first trying to say that it was insecticides. You know, then it was crickets chirping.
Don't forget the paper about the Hall effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that, like, you... Well, for this whole haunting effect that happens with people who are having these issues.
Yeah, that my book has caused the targeting.
That it's caused, like, a state almost of
when everybody knows that it's Robert Duncan's book that caused it.
That's right, that's right. It's How to Tame a Demon that caused it. Yeah. It's all you, Dr. Duncan.
Yeah, not guinea pigs. it's all Duncan. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, the technology of this, once again, we've talked numerous times about it. I've got the patents and papers on the knowledge. The microwave activated bug that was in the U.S. Embassy back in the 60s, that they found behind the seal of the United States. Utterly passive, had no battery, point a microwave at it, and it powers the device and sends a signal back.
And that is a lot of what's being used now. Now, this all can be done without any type of chipping.
Yeah.
But now we're also getting technology, and those are, for the most part, passive in nature.
Let's get into some of that real quick, because not everybody understands nanotechnology.
I can get into it a little bit. Because some of that I'll be violating the order.
Yes.
What would you like to get into?
Well, yeah, a little bit of what the nanotechnology is, period. Because we hear this buzzword all the time in scientific articles. Of course, there's the idea of, like, nanobots destroying the world as a gray ooze because they're trying to multiply each other and just take matter.
Well, the issue with nanotechnology is it's, for one, it's too small to see. It can't be picked up on MRI or CT typically. Unless scar tissue forms around it in the body, then you can kind of ascertain where it is based on ultrasound or CT. Most of it is passive in nature. It's either powered by muscles contracting. Some of them are designed where particles can find each other in the body and then reconnect to each other.
Yeah.
Now this is all relatively new technology. You got to remember that a lot of this targeting that we talk about, it, some of the earliest of it was starting in 1980 or so at the Utah prison, when there were Utah prisoners there that said, I had an electric field on me in a cell. They were experimenting on me. It was so repressive that I couldn't even get out of my cot. I had people talking to me, and they were responding appropriately to my answers in thought. So they were already describing what we call synthetic telepathy.
Sure.
And that was in 82. So at that time, I don't think it was nanotechnology. I mean, if it was, then certainly the government was way advanced.
Well, much more likely the fact of inductive loop technology. Yeah. I mean, of course, there were the studies done by the Russian government years and years ago about soft hypnosis being done through the flicker of lights. I mean, every light is flickering at 1/60th. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
60 cycles.
And if you remember, even you know, Delgado with the MK Ultra, before he passed away, he said, we don't need to chip anybody.
Yeah.
We can do all of this with broadcasting.
Yeah.
Now, he called it broadcasting, but, and obviously, at least from our studies early on, in the 90s, we took, you know, groups of, you know, 15, 20, 100 TIs, and we took them out onto boats in the Gulf. We took them onto ranches where we knew for a fact there was no electricity, no Wi-Fi,
no RF signal,
no cell. Then you could find those places.
Sure.
And they still heard voices, and, you know, they still were attacked. So, I mean, we studied it. We scanned, you know, thousands of people. Did we find chips? Yeah, we found some chips in some people. Bob Boise was one of them in Georgia. That turned out to be a Verichip. We're working with some people now that, you know, Hildegard Staninger and some other doctors that are working nanotechnology through techniques that they're kind of doing more like environmental type studies to find, are you having signs of lithium and heavy metals and carbon in you that shouldn't be there, you know, which is difficult studying, and it really takes an expert like Staninger or somebody to do it, because we live in a polluted environment now where if you're pumping gas in your car and breathing those fumes, or you're breathing exhaust fumes or anything else, you're going to get in your body.
Yeah, we're all walking around with packs of lithium with us all the time.
Yeah, and that can be found. And, well, kind of like, you know, when Jesse Ventura did, you know, his show that I was supposed to be on, Robert Duncan graciously volunteered at my request to be on it, and was kind of vilified in that episode. But one of the guys that we actually was in that show that I did for Discovery Channel was dealing with targeting that the government didn't allow to be released here. It was released in Europe, but wasn't released here. I'm trying to even remember the name of it. This was years ago. But there was a guy there that had a lump in his neck, and when the lump was removed, the voices and stuff went away. And I took the lump and took it to an electron microscopy lab here at the University of San Antonio and had it examined. Well, in the meantime, edited the whole episode, tried to release it in the United States. The government said, no, you're not going to release it here. So they released it in Discovery Europe, and you can still find that show if you YouTube or if you Google it, out of Finland. At the end of the show, basically we said, well, you know, we removed this lump, you know, you've got a history of schizophrenia, it might be mental illness. We won't know till we examine this. Well, they finished the editing and actually aired the show before the sample was examined. Well, when I got the results back from the electron microscopy lab, the lump had lithium in it, lithium and titanium.
Wow.
Because even at the microscopy lab, the scientists there called me and they said, what did you give us? And I said, well, it was tissue out of a guy's neck, out of the side of his neck, which kind of looked like a lymph node. And they said, well, this thing's filled with spicules of titanium and lithium, you know, which shouldn't be lithium metal, not a lithium salt. And I said, well, this is a guy that was hearing voices. And they said, well, come get your sample. Here's your report. We don't want anything to do with this. Of course, by that time, it had already been released by Discovery. And in the meantime, before the show was released, this guy passed away from a heart attack. So he never did even get to know his final results. And people that knew him, basically kind of saw him, you know, get an answer at the end of the show that was like, well, maybe it's mental illness, maybe you're targeted.
Yeah.
The guy was strange. You know, I mean, he, you know, had telescope set up looking at his neighbors and stuffed animals behind the telescope. So it looked like there was somebody standing behind them and would watch 10 TVs at one time and, you know, was hearing things in white noise. But
like you said, not lithium salt, not like lithium HCL, where it would be
lithium ion.
A tablet that you would take for mental illness. I had a lithium battery blow up and catch fire on my friggin' workbench. Told my mom, get the baby and get out of the house.
Yeah.
Like, people do not realize how toxic lithium is. Yeah. So, and that's why they were like, where'd you get this? Because, once again, lithium salt would be one thing. Yeah. You know, like lithium HCL, whatever. But not lithium metal. What are some of the toxicities that could happen to somebody with that? Even titanium.
Well, the problem is excrete them. You know, the only way to get rid of metals in the body is by chelation, and some metals can't be chelated.
Yeah.
The biggest problem from a medical point of view with any of those metals is they end up messing up your, you know, conduction system in your heart. Your heart's all based on sodium and calcium ions moving back and forth. And any time you start embedding a lot of metals into that, it's like wiring. You get one of those hooking up your new car stereo, you cut that spade into a hot power line to spade into something else. Well, it works for a little while until that spade starts to jiggle loose. Yeah. And then it starts shorting out not only your stereo, but whatever that initial power wire was powering.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, and it causes myopathies and all kinds of other, can collect in your eyes, cause retinal damage. And, you know, years ago, luckily I'm old enough that I actually saw several patients with ageria, which was back in the 40s and 50s, people would get silver iodide nasal drops sinuses. And it would clear your sinuses, and it's kind of like being addicted to Afrin or neosinephrine. Yeah. Now, they would use it over and over and over until you would embed silver in your body, and we called it Tin Man Syndrome.
Wow.
And these people embedded so much silver in their skin that they looked like a tin man. They looked gray. And I actually had two patients in my lifetime, older people that had used these silver iodide nose drops that to physically look at them, they looked like they were made out of pewter.
And imagine what that would actively do to your brain, since that's quite literally the first place that's going.
Well, and because and everything in the body is electric, you know, everything in your body is bioelectric based on, you know, movement of sodium and potassium, ions through sodium potassium channels. So.
Well, and we had Dr. Robert Duncan on just a couple weeks ago. Hey, Dr. Duncan. And we were specifically talking about the ways in which the body can be influenced by a distance. It doesn't take much, just like it doesn't take much to control the populace. It only takes like 4 to 5%.
Yeah.
That's it. It doesn't take an overwhelming percent to turn the tide or make something happen. And it only takes a good 4 or 5% of something occupying your brain space, anything like that, to literally drive you to a point where cortisol levels build up over serotonin, where you're in a state of constant panic instead of a state of natural panic, where you're responding to something in the world around you in a natural animalistic way, adrenalized. But these targeted individuals literally are targeted so much that their cortisol builds up, that they live in a state of constant fear.
Well, your cortisol builds up to a point, and then you start to deplete your cortisol, and then that's when you become sick.
Oh,
you know, so, I mean, you can only cortisol to respond to stress until your body starts to give up and break down. And then that's when you see a lot of chronic illness come in, a lot of visual, problems and, fertility problems and And of course, you know, if you weren't having mental illness before you were targeted, then you were certainly eventually drives you crazy as well, too.
Yeah.
You can only be targeted so long before you, no one can handle 24/7 targeting without having some form of PTSD from it.
So. Absolutely. And there are examples out there. I mean, when we first met, it was Aaron Alexis.
Yeah.
Once again, Navy Yard.
Yeah.
The Navy Yard shooting. And this is my ELF, my electronic low frequency weapon.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the joys of working with Robert Duncan is I kind of come at things from a medical point of view. He obviously comes at things from a physics.
Oh yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, point of view, and then we kind of, you know, meet in the middle. And of course, if nano is a player, then that brings a whole other dimension to it, which I've said all along. You know that. MK Ultra never actually stopped.
Mm.
You know, MK Ultra has just improved itself over the years as technology improved itself.
Yeah,
you
know, to the point of not needing drugs.
Yeah,
just like the doctor said.
Yeah,
we don't need drugs to do that. We don't need to come in physical contact with you to do that. Nothing.
And that's one of the early reasons when you know why we knew that you know targeting. You know, it initially at least wasn't done with widespread spraying or anything like that.
Yeah.
Because it, you know, it, there was a time when probably as a whole nationwide or even globally, there was, you know, probably 100,000, you know, 200,000 people that were voicing complaints. If it had been done by broadcasting smart dust or something like that, you would have expected to have millions of people complaining about it, but there wasn't. Or it's been perfected to the point where, you know, and I have always said that the people who find themselves targeting become targeted individuals. They're the people who realize there's something that's happening to me and they're being vocal about it. So they're targeted more to silence them or at least make them look crazy so other people don't listen to them. While the rest of the population that is also possibly being targeted is only being controlled.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And we got into that with Dr. Duncan, the fact that it is so easy, once again, to control the whole of society with just a part. And primary media.
Yeah.
That in and of itself, Facebook got its funding from InQtel. They are the financial arm of the CIA. They find emerging technologies. A lot of people forget that the first big thing that happened on Facebook was the overthrow of Hosni Mubarak.
Yeah.
Like some random dude who they never actively found was like, you know what we should do? We should all meet elsewhere. Like, who else has had enough of this? And once again, it did not take the overwhelming population of Egypt to come into the town square and overthrow the government. It was like 8-9%.
Well, if you look at our last election, even.
Yeah.
You know, you had Twitter and Facebook decided, well, anything bad about Biden, we're going to not allow to be on the thing, on the platform. So, and of course now, just, I mean, as a matter of
fact, they've had to actively come out and admit the fact that they pushed down articles about Hunter Biden, drug addiction.
As a matter of fact, just today that was on the news where the FBI is now saying, well, yes, we have enough evidence to probably, you know, try him for something or try to convict him for something.
Yeah, Burisma Holdings.
Now, will they? And the money from China, money from Russia. But, you know, will they? You know, who knows? But
we are not in the habit in this country. It's what I've even said about people wanting criminal charges against Trump. They may come down, whatever, but we are not in the habit of putting ex-presidents or present presidents in jail. No, they're
The problem is we are now in a society where basically we have two wings of the same dirty bird. You know, now there are some younger Republicans running now that I think probably are looking, hoping to change society and make it for the better for all Americans. But for the most part, a friend of mine summed it up. He said, most Republicans are Democrats, but no Democrats are Republicans. Meaning that basically we've got two wings that are basically the same politician. They all want bigger government. They all want to control the population. You know, a lot of that's done not so much through control, but financial control.
Oh, absolutely. And when we had futurist Gray Scott on, this was many years ago, he literally went through the studies showing that the typical average, like, elephant memory that people have for details of things, stuff like that, 8 years.
Yeah.
And it's like your policies amongst, you know, Democrat, Republican, and all that, like, seem to rotate every 8 years. That's why.
But see, the problem with that, though, is we have a two-party system.
We do.
Now, you can talk about it. Oh, I'm going to vote independent, and I'm voting for the Green candidate, or I'm voting for... They will never win. You know, you've got two choices, Democrat or Republican. We're going to need people in politics that are ethical enough, ones that bring this to an end. Because the answer is not going to be finding, shielding. You'll never... As the technology continually changes, you'll never be able to shield it completely.
Yeah.
Or you won't be able to afford to shield it completely. We don't have...
Oh, you got to have a hardened bunker to be sealed against satellite weaponry.
Yeah.
Well, and microwaves.
Well, or even 5G.
Yeah.
You know, now, you know, you're used to, you could go someplace and get out of a Wi-Fi field. You can't really go anywhere and get out of Wi-Fi now. There's 5G, the stations are, every 50 yards.
Yeah.
The problem is that the solution is political.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, so many TIs that I talk to are like, well, we need to form our own research groups and find ways to shield ourselves. Is there a suit I can wear? And, you know, well, you realistically can't live life in a anechoic chamber.
Yeah.
You know?
And, yeah.
And you've got to be able to live and at least try to live normally and appear like you're normal, you know, to avoid, you know, psychiatric diagnosis. And that's going to take political change. The answer, and that's why a lot of people would bitch about my books and say, well, kind of are a political rant. Well, that's because the answer has to be political. It's got to be us stopping putting in crappy people into positions of power.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the people who quite literally don't make laws to prevent experimentation, that do not make laws protecting yourself as an actual digital person and a digital entity, things like that. We are one of the only countries in the world where these laws do not exist. Countries, like, let's just put it in the terms of UN or NATO countries.
Yeah.
All right, let's just leave it there. But
well, and we're broadcasting from San Antonio.
Yeah,
we're in it right now. We've got an administration that's not even protecting our own border.
Yeah.
You know, we're spending billions of dollars protecting a border in Ukraine when we have, 100,000 people a day coming across the border that are caught, another 100,000 a day coming across the Texas border that aren't being caught.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't know, are they terrorists? Are they drug related? But we do know that they're letting it happen intentionally to change the demographics of the voting population. You know, so... That tells you a lot right there. And Republicans aren't stopping it either.
No.
So, I mean, I'm not bitching that it's a Democratic thing.
No, 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 no.
It's a Democrat.
It's a whole government.
Yeah. It's
a whole government.
It's the Democrats allowing it right now, but you don't see many who are trying to figure out a way to stop it.
Yeah. And we have to be willing to be open and mind to see that. We have to be willing to, A, vote incumbents out and challenge them on these topics. Bring it up, because once again, until just this last year, there was not anything about UFO UAPs until they found out that these programs existed and that they never approved the programs. And suddenly, the oversight committees became really pissed about the fact that these programs and this data was being gathered, and they were never read on to the fact, and they were never asked for the funds. You know, and now suddenly we've had UFO UAP hearings, all that kind of stuff. So
that'll be interesting to see where that really is going.
Well, and I've said since the beginning of that, quite honestly, everything, the way it's happened, the fact that Lou Elizondo apparently at some point held top secret clearance, or at least top level secret clearance, released videos that, well, they were approved for, they were declassified, but not declassified for media release. And even though he went to the government, he went to the media with him, he still kept his government clearances. Then he managed to go into the and pick up another government contract researching these things. And, like, it's interesting.
Yeah.
So to me, it really looks like a planned dissemination of information, because the only way you're going to be able to monetize this technology or bring it about is to say we either got it from somewhere or here it is.
Well, and the other thing, like I think we've talked about before too, is that if both sides of the government are clamoring for a global economy and a global new world order to a global economy, that you're going to need a global boogeyman.
Yeah.
And that global boogeyman was supposed to be climate change. And too many people are not buying that, you know, because how much do you have to tax me to change the climate? If you can't tell me if it's even going to rain tomorrow, I don't think you can tell me what the temperature is going to be in 100 years. I don't think the technology's there. But, you know, they're willing to break the middle class, you know, under taxation to protect us from climate change. Yeah. You know, they're trying to force everybody to buy electric cars when California can't even keep their grid on. You know, if everybody's charging electric cars, then and we're in Texas, you know, even a $60,000 electric car has about a 280-mile range. I can't make it to my Corpus clinic, you know, on one charge. I would have to stop and charge it for 8 hours, you know, to get there. And that's what a lot of people don't realize. Charging an electric car is not just plugging it in.
It's not a quick zap.
No, it's
while you're in the store shopping.
No, there are chargers that will charge one in 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah.
But the home chargers...
And with that in mind, just looking at the leaps of technology that have happened, things like that, once again, the inclusion of nanotechnology into this weaponry, the inclusion of media into this weaponry, microwave technology into this weaponry. What do you see is a solution that TIs can have? What can they do to get some peace and some solace in their life, Dr. Hall?
If you have the possibility of, you know, finding places with relatives or something that are far out in the country where you can just get away from electronics altogether, that is certainly one of the better things you can do. Get out of the cities, which is exactly the opposite of what the UN wants.
Mm.
The UN wants you, you know, out of the country and into the cities. You know, that's why they're actually trying to get all the natural land and the resources.
Yeah.
Control the food, control the water, control the natural resources, force the population into urban cities.
21.
Yeah. Well, it's not called that anymore.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. It's got a new name.
That document is on the Knowledge Vault, folks. Yeah. Feel free to go get it.
It still exists in the but it's under a different moniker now. That is one of the things. The other thing is you got to form a political, you know, instead of, you know, arguing amongst each other, you know, we really need to put aside our differences of you're a Democrat, you're a Republican, and pick out the people and hold them accountable. You know, pick out the people that are running and say, are you going to do something about non-consensual experimentation?
Yeah.
Are you going to, you know, force the government to be more honest, you know, with, you know, what they're telling us? Because right now you don't, you know, just like any other.
Oh, absolutely.
In this country.
The
news you're going to get on Facebook is
we would not have literally funded a Department of Anti-Propaganda.
Yeah.
Like.
So we're really in a rough spot because you really can't believe what you're getting as news that you're being broadcasted to.
Yeah.
So it's hard to find any data, even online. You've really got to dig, and you know better than dig through the internet to find data every day. And that's how you found the Hall effect.
Yeah. And just the fact that this has been relegated to the point of, once again, right where UFOs, UAPs were reports of that, where it's like, nope, mass hysteria. This is something else going on. Even the couple of TIs that I've worked with to go out and do electronic scans of their home, things like, they kind of look at me strange when I pull out my lab grade Geiger counter and start going around the house. When I pull out my gas meter and start looking for gas leaks in the house. And when I pull out my carbon monoxide detector, it's like, I'm not doubting you. What I'm trying to do is exclude everything except for the phenomena.
Yeah. And by the way, Chris Jordan also makes binaural beat programs for TIs. Because one of the things that does still work that will give you some relief is using binaural beat programs through bone conduction headphones.
Yeah.
Because the way a lot of this works is by heterodyning the EEG, creating a disturbance wave in the two hemispheres of the brain. And if you can get both hemispheres to operate in the same wavelength again,
yeah,
uniformly, that will give you some relief. And I know that I've referred to you for your binaural beat programs that you and I have.
It inspired me to write my album music for the Targeted Mind.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of it. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Because at least rather than walking around in a shielded suit, to try to shield yourself, if you can just wear bone conduction headphones and listen to music through that, it's actually helping your brain actually resist the entrainment. That is a little more societally accepted.
Because
everybody's walking around with earphones on now, so nobody's going to question that. Now, it does have to be bone conduction. It can't come through the canal. It does have to
be bone conduction. And why is that?
Because you're actually going, that's basically how targeting works too. You're basically interfering with the same signal that's going through the skull.
Yeah.
So your brain doesn't have a chance to actually receive that signal that's coming from a distance. It's receiving a signal that's coming. And those are called aftershocks. Aftershocks headphones are the ones that we studied.
Those are fantastic. I have a pair. They're absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
For those of you who are curious about this, literally feel free to just Google, new weapon vibrates your skull. Feel free to Google, scientists investigate lasers that into your head through your skull. Feel free to Google, MIT scientists talk to dreamers in their dreams. Mm-hmm. Yep. This is all technology that's come about and been announced in the last five, six years.
And that's the funny thing is a lot of people will say, well, there's no way you can put voices in somebody's head.
Yeah,
there's multiple ways you can put voices.
I can do it for three different ways.
Yes, and I've got a audio spotlight at my house.
Yeah.
You can do it with that. You can do it with ultrasonic sound.
Yep.
You can do it with ultrasound. You can do it with laser. I mean, there's a bunch of ways.
Vibrations on their bed, all kinds of things.
As a matter of fact, a little story, and I've told this on your show before, at my old office, they knew that I did a lot of this research and that I, was involved with this. And a lot of my own employees are like, well, a lot of these people sound like they're crazy when they call. And I said, well, most of these people are being experimented on. They're not crazy. They're at their wit's end.
Yeah.
And they're people that are trying to make sense of a technology that's not easy to make sense of.
Yeah.
And especially not easy to make sense of anymore, because it may be different modalities that different people are being attacked by, not just. And so I thought, I'll teach them a lesson. So I have a little device that uses ultrasonic sound to give you a headache.
Yeah.
And some people can hear it. Most people can't. So, and you can set it up in a room and it will cause severe headache and distress in a room full of people. So I brought it in, takes a 9-volt battery, hooked it up, sat it in one corner of a room in the office. It wasn't on for probably 5 minutes when I had 5 or 6 employees coming back. They're going, we've all got pounding. About to be at each other's throats. Whatever you're doing, turn it off. And I say, why do you hear something? No, but we know you're doing something. So I said, well, it's this little device that's about this big. Yeah. And it was in one corner of one room and was affecting the entire office.
Yeah. Yeah. And, there's a lot of technology out there. We place ourselves around a lot of technology. Really one of the best things you can do. I've got for a long time. Into it, Black Sabbath. Try having a day without technology. Literally cut your phone off for one day a week. Mine used to be Sundays. It was the one day that I wasn't on broadcast. I didn't watch TV. I didn't do anything like that.
Or sit in a restaurant. How many times do you see anybody having lunch together and actually having a conversation? You see this.
Yeah.
They're sitting there, there'll be 4 people.
Here's a great home experiment that you can do. Quite literally chart your sleep pattern for about a month. And then for another month, start turning off your Wi-Fi when you go to bed. Just unplug the router.
Yeah.
And start charting your sleep.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised how more solid you sleep without that Wi-Fi on, without the phone constantly sending a burst of energy, of RF energy out that basically to our brain is the equivalent of like a white flash.
Or a flash from a camera. See the anger that comes out of a teenager when you take their phone.
Yeah.
You know,
almost addiction.
Because especially anger. The generation from 30 years old down, you know, that cell phone is part of their being.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of
part of their identity intrinsically.
It's kind of like my wife when I took her burner phone, you know, and she came out. You know, so.
Oh, man. John, I can't thank you enough. I know I've been chasing you for a while to come back on, and you've been going through everything. I'm so glad that you're still alive. You were still here. You were still fighting the good fight. Like I said, I get Facebook messages about how's Dr. John Hall doing? Have you talked to him? I get emails on the website, all kinds of things. So I'm glad you came on tonight.
And I would like to thank everybody. I have had a lot of the TI community reach out and support because they could tell on my Facebook that I was going through. Appreciate the support.
It's not often that a crusader like you shuts down their crusade on social media. And that's because of the court case and everything else, what you've literally had to do to protect the individuals that
the other court, not the divorce.
Yeah, yeah, not the divorce.
That is a big case, and it's. Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't want it to become life threatening to you know, me or my daughter or my ex-wife. So
absolutely. Well, thanks once again. We appreciate it. I can't wait till we get to hang out again. I always love spending time.
And remember, you're coming hunting this hunting season.
Oh, I can't wait. Yeah. I can't wait. So
all right.
Take care, brother.
Thank you, Chris.
While you are online checking everything out, folks, make sure to stop on by Amazon, buy the books,
Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control. And A New Breed.
A New Breed, Satellite.
Terrorism in America.
There you go. Right after this, we will be right back with the amazing Lyle Blackburn talking about his new book, Bigfoot in Texas, as well as other cryptids in Texas and the world of cryptozoology, right after this.
With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spigeric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25 milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is CURIOUS7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultation and workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training, and use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is PodcastCadet.com.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Curious Realm. In a pre-recorded fashion yet again this week, I am still on the road with work, but more than pleased to be bringing on cryptozoology researcher and author and musician with the band Ghoultown, the amazing Lyle Blackburn. We'll be talking about his new book, here in my hand, Texas Bigfoot. What brought him to write this book? What brought him into the field of cryptozoology? All that kind of stuff. So let's go ahead and get into it and bring him on. Hey, Lyle, how you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. I actually ran into you, as always, at a Texas Bigfoot event this last week, or I guess 2 weeks ago now, at the Texas Bigfoot Conference. And always great to see you. I love watching your presentations. You actively rivet an audience when you are commanding the stage. So thank you so much for always coming out to those things, sharing your vast wealth of knowledge with everybody about these topics.
Yeah, no problem. I love to obviously to talk and share these stories and my perspective, and it's always fun to meet up at the events. It seems like we've seen each other quite a few times this yeah. year, just because there's so many of these, you know, Bigfoot conferences and other kinds of events that have been popping up. You know, people just love this stuff.
Oh, yeah. And it's interesting because over the last few years, it has really, really hit the mainstream. To the fact that now they're, you know, almost like you could turn on like A&E almost any day of the week and catch like a 9 hour long, like Law and Order marathon. It's about the same way on Travel Channel and that kind of stuff. Like there's just hours and hours of Bigfoot show marathons all over the place now. Paranormal marathons, ancient aliens, things like that. These topics have really, really come to light to the general public over the last few years, and come honestly to the point where people are much more willing to come forward with their accounts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, over the last, well, more than a decade, there's just been an increasing amount of those quality shows that cover these subjects. And I think that's shown people that if you've seen something unexplainable, it doesn't mean you're crazy, you know, because just, yeah, you know, your average next door neighbor is just apt to see something, you know, that's strange, and nobody has that sort of stigma anymore about seeing these things. So I think more of these things have come out, and certainly makes it easier for, you know, researchers like myself and such to find compelling witnesses.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, you, speaking of your research, like you are quite literally the tome of information when it comes to the Falk Monster in Falk, Arkansas. It's incredible the number of people that come to you with witness sightings, things like that. What was it that originally, I guess, piqued your interest and brought you into this really amazing field of research, man? Because it's not like you can, like, you know, go take a college course in cryptozoology. It's not like exactly a major study of courses in college or anything. So what was it that kind of brought you down this rabbit hole to begin with?
Well, you know, that's true. It's not something you really ever think about doing in a, you know, full-time fashion, you know. And, you know, of course, when I was a kid, you know, I first, from as far back as I could remember, I loved monster movies and horror movies and Frankenstein and Wolfman. Yeah. And then in early elementary school, I got a book called Strange But True, and that had stories of Bigfoot, the Yeti, and Loch Ness Monster. And that's the first time I had heard of, you know, sort of quote-unquote monstrous creatures that may actually exist in the world. And, of course, that blew my mind. I'm like, whoa, this sounds so cool. And that kind of, you know, turned me onto the subject. And then at some point, I was born and raised in Fort Worth, Texas, in that area. And there was a movie that came out called The Legend of Boggy Creek, which came out in the 70s. And I saw that when I was really young. And that dramatized sightings of a hairy, scary southern Sasquatch-like creature in southern Arkansas, not far from where we lived in North Texas. And, of course, that really did it for me, because I felt like, wow, you know, there could be things in our surrounding woods, not, you know, stuff right off in Scotland. And so that's one reason The Legend of Boggy Creek became something that I researched and wrote about a lot, and sort of what got me, I guess, jump-started into this field, if you will, because that had been such a fascination for me. And then as an adult, I wanted to find out what is the truth behind the movie, because it, you know, it said it was based on true encounters. So, you know, you take that for what it is in a movie when you're a kid. But as an adult, that just became my major focus of research initially.
Yeah. And it once again, an amazing body of research to the point that you have become basically the unofficial expert on Falk and the Falk monster sightings.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, nobody had really covered it in detail. In my first book called The Beast of Boggy Creek, which talked about sightings of the creature in that area and the history of that, as well as the making of The Legend of Boggy Creek, which was a huge, huge sensation in the 70s. I mean, this was a movie made by a first-time filmmaker out of Arkansas, and it went on to be distributed in drive-ins and theaters around the country and made millions of dollars. I mean, for having been made for just pennies, really.
Yeah.
You know, and so when my book came out, and that's about the time back in, you know, I don't know, 12 years ago or something, when a lot of these shows were being launched, like Finding Bigfoot, Monsters and Mysteries in America. So I was on episodes that where they covered the Fouten monster. So that kind of put me out there as the guy who was the go-to for Boggy Creek, which is really cool and a great honor. I would have never thought I would in my life. And, you know, that kind of always is sort of my ongoing research. Even if I write other books and stuff, I'm still trying to pay attention and track any sightings or things of interest in that area.
Yeah, and Texas is a panoply of cryptids and cryptozoology. I guess the first time that I started, I mean, I'd heard about, I want to say it was the Texas Bigfoot Research Association or something like that that had started decades ago over near the Sam Houston National Forest. But it wasn't until I was in my easily late 20s and out at a campfire in Louisiana and saw a mountain lion go by. And somebody, oh, there's no mountain lions up around here. And then I started looking into it. And then I found out even about the jaguarless in Houston and sightings of that. And that took me down the rabbit hole of Texas cryptids at that point, and sightings and the differences between like the Texas chupacabra and the typical paranormal chupacabra that you hear about, things like that.
Right. And, you know, Texas is it's a huge state. So, you know, it encompasses a variety of geographical areas and certainly, you know, there's these sorts of mysteries and mysterious creatures, throughout the U.S. And Texas is just big enough to encompass quite a few various cryptids. I mean, from Bigfoot to Chupacabra, goat men, lizard, reptilian humanoids, other thunderbirds,
pteranodons,
pteranodons, just you name it. There's a little bit of everything here in Texas, and that's, you know, it makes it a great place to live and to sort of have a hub of research out of here.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, with even considering the fact that, like, other than frozen tundra, Texas has literally just about every land type in the world, you know, so it, like the idea of different types of ranging animals being able to live in the same state, absolutely possible here.
True. You know, and a lot of people, if they haven't traveled Texas much, even people who live in Texas probably don't realize that, it's not just sort of a cowboy landscape, you know, people have this vision of wide open ranches and stuff. When in fact the state is very heavily forested, in the eastern third, it's known as the Piney Woods. And I mean, it's heavy pine wood forests, thickets. There's even swampy areas as we progress over towards Louisiana. So it is a place where you can easily imagine creatures such as Bigfoot being able to, move and survive, if we consider they exist, that Texas isn't, just sort of a one type place where you might see a chupacabra. It can certainly encompass very wooded areas.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And very inaccessible wooded areas as well. So it's, and the amount of wildlife and other foraging material that are out there is vast.
Right, right. And, you know, that's one thing that's required. I mean, if these creatures are flesh and blood or terrestrial or what have you, they're going to require sustenance and the ingredients to survive. So, you know, you have to first look at, what is the landscape? You know, could whatever exit creature actually thrive here? And if it's a landscape where they could, then obviously that supports the credibility of sightings.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, even when I was speaking with Adam Davies at the conference, he said that is the first thing that he starts with his research is, can the localized area where these sightings have been seen, and most of his work is in the realm of cryptids and other creatures that, you know, Aboriginal people and Indigenous people around the world have seen and talked about, and that there are recent modern sightings of. And he said that if he can't see the fact that there is a sustainable environment and a possible sustainable food source for this creature or a sustainable population of them, he doesn't even go research it.
Right. Yeah. And then, you know, that's sort of something that you have to look at in the big picture, you know, and he certainly is somebody who's explored not just, you know, North America and such. He's been all over and is very familiar with, you know, stories of creature sightings as well as the varied landscapes in which they're reported. So that's certainly one thing we're going to look at, you know, as far as, you know, the credibility and possibility that any of these said creatures could live where, you know, people are reporting them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Now in your research, how do you go about, I guess, tackling a field investigation?
Well, you know, I mean, first, you know, if you get, you know, contacted by a witness, for example, and they have a, you know, a compelling story, and if you are able to speak to them by phone or communicate in some way and determine that, you know, this is something that's worth pursuing, and it's, and, you know, in some cases, people tell you about older sightings, and sometimes they're very recent. So if it was a case where I felt like I could, you know, get up there and check it out or what have you, you know, then you just see about, you know, taking a trip out there and looking at the area. And, you know, it can just encompass, you know, just whatever you can do. And I mean, that could range from just simply interviewing the witness and having them show you where the incident occurred, or, you know, or set up out there in camp and take a look around yourself. You know, so I've done all varieties and manner of that, you know, over the years, and just sort of fielding these reports and, you know, just trying to be able to investigate them firsthand as much as possible. But obviously it requires a lot of time and, you know, money and things that aren't, you know, not funded by any scientific organization or anything like that. So it all just kind of is dependent on logistics and economics sometimes.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's not like you can go out and like apply for a federal grant for Sasquatch research.
Right. And you know, people have tried, but very few and far between has anybody ever gotten some independent funding, you know, because that's how it works. And I think, you know, I get a lot of questions or people say, you know, you could really prove it if you could go out there for 6 months in some place. I'm like, yeah, that's great. How do you live or take care of your responsibilities without some funding, which is how, you know, science works. If you're an archaeologist or other things, you know, much of that requires grants and scholarship and, you know, funding in order for those people to go to some remote location and dig.
Yeah.
You know, that's how all that works. And you're seeing as how, you know, cryptozoology, if you will, is not really a recognized science or typically valued much by academia. There's just no one that's going to give you funding. That's just not hardly going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Which, you know, of course is sad and stymies some of the science, but at the same token, you know, it's one of those that, with that being said, anything that you find, you would not be necessarily beholden to anybody like you would be if you were under a grant or anything like that, where maybe your research could be buried rapidly or, that kind of stuff. So there is the advantage of that, despite the expense of having to do it.
Right, certainly. It's kind of like independent, you know, it's in, you're independent. So, yeah, you would, if you could do it and you happen to find something, you're going to have ownership of that and reap whatever rewards may come. And whereas you're not owned, you know, it's kind of like a band or something that's, you know, either on a major label, or you're an indie band that has your own label, you know, you would own more of the, of it than otherwise. So yeah, you're exactly right. That, an advantage.
Yeah. Yeah. You get more distribution, everything else. And I mean, even it's, to look at it as literally a way to, I guess, because the, it was great to hear Shelley Covington Montana talking about the concept of citizen science and the idea of science, and people forget about that concept because, like, hey, Hail Bop, that was a citizen science, you know, like things like that. We regularly discover new astronomic bodies because of people with telescopes in the backyard. So there are independent people out there that are willing to help fund research, that are even willing to go out and help with research.
Right, right. And so, you know, that's kind of always been the makeup of any of studies of any sort of phenomenon, scientific or on the fringe, is you've definitely got people contributing that are just doing it on their own. And there's really, it's a level playing field. I mean, you could just be as lucky as the next guy, funding or not, if you're just in the right place at the right time or look, sure, point your telescope in the right way, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. And, you know, with that in mind real quick, because one of the two things I hear regularly in our discussion forum is, how come we never see a clear image of a Bigfoot? How come we never see a clear image of a UFO if these things are out there? And how come we have no proof? Is there proof of Sasquatch, of a large hominid species, possibly here in North America or otherwise, Lyle?
Well, there is no proof. I mean, in terms of proof that, you know, would be recognized by science at large, you know, to identify a type specimen and catalog it and give it a species name or what have you. It's, you know, there is, you know, what would be considered possible concrete evidence, such as the footprints and hair samples and things like that. I mean, the pictures less, you know, less.
Sure.
But, you know, since there's, you know, those, the footprints are still subjective, since there's nothing to compare them to, there's no type specimen to say, yep, this matches what we know, such as a, you know, maybe a bear track. You look at the track, you go, oh yes, it definitely matches this, the foot anatomy of this bear, or, you know, grizzly bear or black bear or what have you.
Yeah.
Whereas Sasquatch just remains basically unproven.
Well, sure. However, even in many of the tracks that are out there, there are dermal ridges, all kinds of, you know, actual physiological evidence to show. It's not like somebody with a wooden form on their foot walking around the woods, you know.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's definitely tracks that you know, all perspectives seem to have come from a actual, you know, physical being there of some sort that stepped into the ground. And, you know, that's can be judged by the morphology of the tracks and the, you know, like the dermal ridges, which are sort of like fingerprints. I mean, if you see that kind of stuff, that it's harder to fake, you know, and you see people with sort of the stamped wooden prints, though, you know, those are easy to rule out and say, look, that doesn't look like anything natural. So those other ones build the body of evidence just to say that, well, you know, we may be on the right track here, because while this doesn't prove the creature, it certainly shows that there's something to it beyond just people claiming to see them.
Sure.
There's also something left behind, something that we can examine after the fact.
Yeah, yeah, and there's all kinds of interesting things coming out right now about oil prints and alleles coming from that, and so many more things that can be done with hair samples, blood samples, things like that, as far as being able to trace it. The risks of contamination in the field are no longer what they were even 3 years ago, 2 years ago, when it comes to testing kits, things like that.
Right. There's definitely the technology is coming along that, you know, could sway the difference, you know, and ED, yeah. Something like eDNA and, mm-hmm. and DNA itself, you know, become a little bit more accessible and affordable for stuff like this. So, you know, there could be a point where a footprint could be, you know, analyzed for presence of DNA, you know, and
yeah.
some of it, again, it's back to economics and who's going to, what Bigfoot researcher can afford these and how, and who can you persuade to conduct these tests. But as things come down in cost and they're more technologically advanced, certainly that is going to provide advantage for this situation that, yeah, like we didn't have certainly 50 years ago. And even, you know, 3 years ago, it's progressed since then. So it's always moving forward.
Yeah, yeah. There is a huge march in technology right now with what is going on scientifically with, once again, the new examination methods being used for even previous evidence of footprints, things like that. Now, along with this, I guess, march of science and the march of society along with Sasquatch and cryptozoology has really, really come, I guess, the crossover between cryptid research and the paranormal. And
right. You've seen it definitely. The intersection of what may have been looked at as just simply a field science situation to whether, you know, creatures are, you know, these creatures are more paranormal in nature.
Yeah, yeah. And especially, I think, since the work at Skinwalker Ranch with Robert Bigelow and the reports of a portal opening and a creature walking out and then walking into another portal. The reports of Sasquatch and portals and the connection with the paranormal have really grown.
Yeah. I mean, I've definitely seen that, especially in about the last 5 years, just a lot of that, you know, showing up on Facebook and such where, you know, people can express their theories and opinions. So, you know, I've seen a drastic sway of more of a paranormal aspect to all this stuff. Although, granted, it's certainly always been there. I mean, even in the heyday of the golden era of sort of Bigfoots and UFOs and all that in the 70s, they intersected quite a bit. You know, and so it's always been sort of under that umbrella of paranormal. And certainly the definition of paranormal is something outside the normal, which Bigfoot obviously is as an unproven or any cryptid. And, you know, but I think lately there's been sort of a switch to where people believe that. And I think that's only natural because where you have studies of these creatures that have gone on for upwards of 50 years of intense, you know, looking into it, yet we still don't have, you know, a body or absolute proof, then, you know, the theories are going to have to, you know, people are trying to just figure out how in the hell people can be seeing these things, yet we still don't have a physical body. So I certainly understand why more radical theories just sort of get circulated just to simply try to get our mind around the whole phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah, most definitely, because I had the conversation with researcher Jason McClellan while I was there at the conference a couple weeks ago about, I believe that there is a definite hominid creature in North America and beyond. Anecdotal stories from tribal cultures that have unbroken oral traditions have talked about this and talked about what the relationship with these creatures as though they are a tribe across the trees from them. But I believe that these people have crossed into something or into a place where this exists and that exists at the same time. I'm not sure I'm in the camp myself of, you know, Sasquatch can generate portals, things like that. But I believe that there is definitely a Sasquatch, and I definitely know that there are portals. Like, heck, NASA found a portal that goes to the sun, you know? So they exist. They're out there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly, you know, I think it's just a matter of what is the relationship or, if any, between all these things. And, you know, you do have those Skinwalker Ranch reports, like the one where the couple of guys said they saw what they thought was some sort of a portal opening and a Bigfoot looking creature came out. So, I mean, if you take that at face value, you're like, well, okay, how does this fit in? Is it an exception? Is it the rule? Is it, you know, is this equivalent to what your average person sees in the woods? I don't know. And I certainly never proposed to have all the answers.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some ways, just with my books and things, I mean, I just typically my approach is to document cases and stories, especially ones like Boggy Creek or the Lizardman case of South Carolina, where it just changed. The sightings of this creature were publicized. They changed the small towns themselves. You have these witnesses. It's a, you know, the stories are just compelling and interesting and wild and crazy. And but the answers themselves, you know, I often just say, well, I don't propose to have the answers, but here is all of what went on. Here's to the best of our ability to document in thorough detail these, you know, and many times famous or infamous cryptid cases. Heck, you know, let's all just, we all have our own view as to,
yeah,
how to explain it.
Well, yeah. And I mean, it's also one of those, everybody views the world and their experiences through the lens of their experience, you know? So it can be hard, even if two people are at the same sighting, to get the same story.
Yes, and certainly, I mean, you know, we have to understand that eyewitness testimony is fallible and sure, often, you know, subject to the perspective of the person, mm-hmm, with a lot of variables. So, you know, I think we have to sometimes think that, well, acknowledge that, you know, some of these sightings, while the witnesses may be adamant they had seen something or whatever, are subject to mistakes and wishful thinking or what have you. But even if we discard all the ones that seem sketchy, mm-hmm, there are still good number, a handful even, that just stand up to scrutiny, to where you're like, man, these people saw something.
Yeah.
That we just can't explain. Yep. And that's what drives powers the boat forward.
Absolutely. And like we say on the show regularly about crop circles, UFOs, UAPs, paranormal, what have you, even though 90-95% of them can be proven as hoax, other than what have you, there's about 5-10% that are really up in the air and are still unidentified, and we do not know. And to not explore that is a true disservice to science.
Certainly. Yeah, then that's the case. I mean, even if only one person saw an actual unidentified flying object that was not from this earth, or if only one person saw a Bigfoot or et cetera, on and on, that's enough right there just to say that, hey, what is that? And certainly, it does come down to just those enthusiasts that are probably outside the realm of science that are going to pursue it. And there is a value to that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you have to be willing to, explore what you may not be able to accept, and you have to be willing to accept when something is not what you would hope it to be.
Yes, and I think that's where oftentimes we do a discredit to the whole thing, because I see people not willing to entertain other possibilities when your mind is made up.
Yeah.
That's not how, certainly not how science works.
Exactly.
And even citizen science, that we have to call it for what it is. And if it isn't what we want it to be, so be it. Fine. There's plenty of other things. And there's, when you argue that something that's obviously ridiculous, to be proof or to be this or that, it makes it all, it just doesn't look good.
Yeah.
As opposed to taking it, let's get the best of the best and put that forward. And then that, you know, that puts validity to the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. And even within people's independent investigations, to cherry pick data or anything like that is no difference than science not looking at something. Like you said, it does a disservice to the whole scientific process of investigation of these phenomena.
Right. And I think, you know, whereas science is sort of you got to be just very balanced and flat and pull any sort of ego out of it. Whereas I see a lot of the ego thing. If you say, look, I took a picture of a Sasquatch, and people go, I think that's a log, you know, and then there becomes a defense of an ego. The ego is insulted. And as soon as you add human egos and other things into what, you know, probably should be more scientific, that is not the way to do it. You know, you have to say, yeah, I see what you're saying. You know, you don't have to agree, and you can argue cases, and that's how it goes. But, you know, is to understand that, and we're just all fumbling around trying to prove this, and it's no knock on anyone's credibility or ego if it doesn't turn out to be, you know, the best proof. It's like, hey, cool. Well, you know, it was cool, and let's move on to some better stuff to debate.
Yeah. Oh, well, absolutely. And I think the key right there is that last word you used, Lyle, debate. That open exchange of ideas, that open thrust, parry, and block, that really does open a conversation. Not where you're trying to change somebody's paradigm or change their mind or convince them of what you believe. But rather you exchanging your ideas, them exchanging theirs, and both of you being open to understanding the point of view.
Right. And that's the thing about me. I don't care what people think or decide. That's totally cool. Whatever it is. I'm not trying to prove something. And if people don't agree with me, totally cool.
Yeah.
You know, very, I just like the subject. And like I said, my books weave a narrative of these incredible stories, and somebody, you know, takes that and expands on it, or they have a different idea, not a problem. I never claim to be able to prove something or that anything's other than just what it is. And all I do is present to the best of my ability an engaging story and to document some of these cases that should be documented for future reference or what have you, and simply that's it. And I'm not going to invest emotionally into the fact that people, various people, are going to have various opinions on it, which it's just cool, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And before we let you go, I guess a couple things about investigation and, I guess, methodology. How can those that are getting into this and wanting to go out and do investigations, wanting to go out and even, you know, make your job easier and gather field reports in their local area, stuff like that. How can they vet witness sightings? What is your process for vetting a witness?
Well, you know, you just, I think if you want to obviously try to speak to the person, if you get contacted and you feel like it's a good report, and, you know, you're going to get a good sense right off speaking on the phone. And again, you got to come from the outside perspective, that until they can convince you that this is something solid, you've got to be skeptical, you know, not the other way around. And I certainly don't presume that somebody's making something up or whatever. I'm open to listen to whomever, but, you know, again, you got to have your radar up, and you've got to, you know, and if this is something really great and you're able to meet with them, obviously that is going to give you an even better idea about the credibility of this person and the possibility that they did and absolutely see something that that can't be explained. So, you know, it just takes a little bit of experience, I guess, and just kind of always being objective and balanced and skeptical so that you're not blindly just accepting everything that comes in, you know. I mean, some of these type things are just red flags all over the place. You know, and I see other...
What's your first red flag?
Well, a lot of times it's... I mean, the couple of the worst red flags are when people are pushy and it seems like they want to get, you know, they want their to be on TV, or they want me to put it in a book or a documentary, and it just seems overly pushy, which puts an agenda on it. Or the other thing is, you know, how much phenomenon, you know, I saw Bigfoot, I saw 47 Bigfoots, I also saw 18 UFOs, and, you know, I mean, they're just like this, where you kind of say, who am I to say? But on the other hand, these things are just, they would have to be more rare. I cannot be running around so much that, you know, you can just go out any given weekend and sure, boom, there's, you have two or three sightings, and, you know, things like that, or people who claim to have lots and lots of activity and they're coming up to the back door and stuff. Look, get a picture or something, you know, and you know, if it's that prevalent. So, when you hear those kind of things, you're just like, as opposed to just some woman who could care less about Sasquatch, doesn't know anything about it, yet she's driving down a rural country road and said, this thing ran out right in front of my car. I was scared to death. I don't know what it was. It wasn't a person. It wasn't a bear. You know, and they just simply saw what they saw, and they're not influenced by Bigfoot on the brain, and they're not trying to give you what I would consider just too much. I mean, extraordinary claims require more extraordinary proof, and
yeah,
you know, just again, just being balanced.
Absolutely. Now, how does somebody who has had an experience, an encounter, a sighting, how do they get a hold of you, Lyle? How do they? What is your means of reporting a sighting to you?
Well, you know, they kind of come in a variety of ways, but I mean, if on my website, lyleblackburn.com, there's actually a submission form there where people can enter in the details and stuff, and it'll come to me. And, you know, some people send me a message on Facebook or or what have you. So, you know, just sort of looking me up, and that's the thing. I mean, there's no one portal for any of this. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of, usually somebody's read my books or seen me on TV and like my approach and feel like that I'm a person who would appreciate or take seriously their experience. So they seek me out, but that could be the same for any of my other colleagues. So, you know, if you have a favorite researcher that you feel like is, you know, the type of person that you want to handle your story, that's the person to reach out to. And then, hey, if it's not in my area or it's not something I can look into but needs to, we have a big network of guys. You know, I say, hey, man, I got, yeah, you know, the, whatever, it's coming from Virginia. Well, I can't get up there from Texas necessarily, but hey, I know a guy who's up there that might want to be interested, that might be interested. So we, you know, we kind of pass these around if we get some really good witnesses. So just awesome. Reach out.
Awesome. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, Lyle. I've been wanting to get you on for a while since we met at the first conference this year, and so glad to finally have you on. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to purchase the book, Texas Bigfoot, where they can go to follow you, subscribe, like, where they can go to catch your podcast, Monster Bizarro, which is amazing. Really like old school radio drama style. I listen to like old school radio dramas on the road to go to sleep, and Monster Bizarro is great. I'm thoroughly enjoying it. So let them know where to go find that, where to go get your monster sauce, and when your next Ghoul Town show is with your band.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot going on actually. So, you know,
you got a little bit.
Right. The best place, you know, you can find out about all my stuff is my website at lyleblackburn.com. And that's got links to all the stuff I do. The books are available at my online store, which there's a link there for autographed copies. But you can also get them all the books on Amazon. You can also see our Small Town Monsters documentaries on Amazon Prime. If you just are in Amazon Prime, search for Lyle Blackburn. Those will come up. My band Ghoul Town, we don't have a gig. We're kind of till next year, we're performing, but, and then what else? Oh yeah. Monster Sauce, my, signature hot sauce. You can grab that from my web store or any number of, cryptid related locations out there, such as, the Bigfoot Museum in Georgia or the one in Oregon. Yeah, so that covers it. But yeah, just hit up my website. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram and all those other good places.
All right. Well, Lyle, thank you so much once again for your time. I look forward to having you on again and again and again, my friend.
Absolutely. I always enjoy seeing you at the events, and I'm glad we could do this because usually at the events, I'm so busy we can't act. It's funny because we're sitting next to each other, but we can't actually hardly get the interview done, but now we're doing it, so that's awesome.
Well, yeah, it's like you get so busy we hardly even have time to sit and visit after. Once again, thank you so much. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.
All right. What an amazing interview from Lyle Blackburn, everybody.